From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Folsom, California.
Noe Valley.
Village in the Park in Daly City.
Potrero Hill.
Glen Park. South Beach.
I live in Bernal Heights.
Coming up, why don't more people take the time to prepare for the end of life?
Of course, we don't like to think of death or dying, but it happens.
Then a Bay Area author spends a week soaking up the wisdom of the Dalai Lama and Archbishop Desmond Tutu.
Archbishop Tutu turns to the Dalai Lama and says, "Act like a holy man." So, I mean, they were just ribbing each other and teasing each other the whole time.
And we'll hear from an Oakland resident who looked for enlightenment by fasting for 21 days.
I guess because I wasn't satisfied with how life is. It doesn't totally make sense to me, you know?
Making spiritual sense of life and death today on Cross Currents. Stay with us. For the last 2 weeks, we've reported on medical care at the end of life and some of the progress that's been made so far. But there's still a long way to go. Death is hard to contemplate, and most Americans are unprepared for the worst to happen, like an accident or an unexpected illness that leaves them brain dead but still alive. That's what happened to Terry Schiavo, a young woman who became comatose after suffering a heart attack in 1990. Schiavo was kept alive by a feeding tube for 15 years. During that time, her husband tried to withdraw the feeding tube, but was adamantly opposed by Schiavo's parents, Congress, and President George W. Bush.
House Republicans rushed to the Capitol from around the country to make a last extraordinary attempt to intervene in the Terry Schiavo case.
After a highly publicized legal battle, the feeding tube was finally removed and Terry Schiavo died 13 days later. If she had completed a document known as an advance directive, this prolonged battle might have been avoided. KALW's Joanne Marr explains what an advance directive is and visits La Crosse, Wisconsin, a town that's become known as the best place to die in America.
Tell me what this is.
This is a power of attorney for healthcare document, which is an advance directive. And it's several pages. One.
Leah Brigham is 81 years old and a great-grandmother. She's lived her entire life in La Crosse, Wisconsin. As she's gotten older, she worries about what will happen to her as she nears the end of life. 8 years ago, she and her husband filled out paperwork called an advance directive with the help of an attorney.
We did not want to be put on feeding tubes indefinitely if there's no chance of recovery. Just let us go.
The idea is to give patients control over their medical care. It's a movement that's grown over the last three decades. Many don't want to be kept alive indefinitely, and the advance directive helps with that. It's a legal document that has two parts. One specifies the kind of treatment patients want if they are no longer able to make decisions.
Patients are reluctant to think about future planning about their health. For some reason, planning for health care decisions can be scary.
Dr. Ruma Kumar is a palliative care specialist and a regional medical director with Kaiser Permanente of Northern California.
Physicians are not good about bringing this up and asking their patients to do their planning, and that, again, for a number of reasons, you know, time constraints might be one of them, or a concern that if you bring up planning, you might make the patient nervous or feel like, you know, you're giving up hope in their treatment plan, then you may not be as apt to bring it up.
But even if an advance directive is filled out, it can get overlooked, misplaced, or ignored by medical staff, as Katie Butler found out.
Hospitals are a world of their own.
Butler is a Bay Area journalist who wrote the best-selling memoir, Knocking on Heaven's Door, The Path to a Better Way of Death.
It has its own rules. It's like a foreign subculture. And once you enter into that system, it can be very, very difficult to get your wishes put into practice.
Butler had her own difficult experiences trying to get her father's advance directive enforced. Butler's 79-year-old father suffered a major stroke in 2002, which caused brain damage and dementia. He had a weak heart, and Butler says he probably would have died of natural causes within 2 years following the stroke. But his pacemaker kept him alive for the next 6 years. In her memoir, Butler writes that the extra years of life caused him great misery.
My father's sight dimmed so much that he could no longer read the New York Times. His balance became so unsteady that my mother could no longer let him walk on his own. He became bowel and bladder incontinent. His brain became so damaged that he could not form a plan to get to the bathroom on time when he needed to. His life went on, thanks perhaps to his pacemaker, and he could do nothing about it but endure. The tipping point had come. Death would have been a blessing, and living was a curse.
Butler's father filled out an advance directive, naming her as his designated medical agent. Butler went to his cardiologist and requested that the pacemaker be turned off.
And the doctor, the cardiologist, not only refused to cooperate, he really treated us as though we were some kind of moral monster. And so there you are. Technically, according to the law, you have the right to request the withdrawal of any form of medical treatment. But you got an advanced device like a pacemaker. You don't know where to go to get someone to help you turn it off if your cardiologist is saying no.
One place Katie Butler might have looked to for help was La Crosse, a small city on the Mississippi River in Wisconsin. It's known for its steamboats, Wisconsin cheese, and its excellent end-of-life care.
We have to get going here. We all have to go milk.
These longtime La Crosse residents meet every week at their local coffee house. They're retired, and they've all completed their advance directives. Michael Sigmund is one of the regular attendees. He says that planning for the end of life is standard procedure in La Crosse.
Before you go actually see the doctor, usually it's the nurse who asks the question. You know, when you first walk in the door or for a quickly after, you know, how are you doing? Do you have any pains today? Do you have an advance directive?
96% of all La Crosse residents who died last year had completed advance directives. That figure far exceeds the number of people who complete advance directives in the Bay Area and the rest of the country. Dr. Bud Hammes is a medical ethicist at La Crosse's Gunderson Health System, a hospital ranked in the top 1% nationwide.
Ultimately, to be as successful as we have been in La Crosse, it isn't just about training a few people to have these conversations with patients. It's actually about changing the culture of the healthcare system and ultimately of the community.
Now, end-of-life conversations and advance directives are part of the hospital's routine practice. An electronic medical record system was created to document patient preferences. That way, the advance directive is easily accessible and can't get lost.
Well, Karen, thank you for coming. This is a very important discussion.
Janet Olmsted is an advanced care planning facilitator at Gunderson. She's assisting Karen with her advance directive. Karen didn't want her last name used. She put off this visit for many years, but finally overcame her hesitancy after speaking with a friend.
I've got to do this. I don't want somebody else stuck with making decisions that they don't. It's like a burden for them to make decisions that, you know, they don't know what I want. So I just thought, now is the time.
Karen says she doesn't want heroic measures or life-prolonging treatments if she's no longer functional. Like Karen, many of Gunderson's patients want medical treatments stopped if there's little or no hope of recovery. Honoring patient preferences has resulted in fewer tests and expensive procedures. Dr. Scott Rathgaber is CEO of Gunderson.
I can't tell you that it's literally millions of dollars that are left on the table, so to speak, because of our commitment to the patients.
Gunderson partnered with the other three local hospitals. It brought churches, social service agencies, and nursing homes together and trained their staffs to do community education and outreach.
It's just the norm for them.
That's Dr. Ruma Kumar with Kaiser Permanente of Northern California. Inspired by La Crosse's success, Kaiser Permanente worked with Gunderson and started its own life care planning program in 2012. Among its goals is to increase the numbers of patients completing advance directives. Over 600 physicians, nurses, and social workers have now been trained as facilitators. Dr. Kumar says much of what Kaiser did was modeled after the Gunderson program.
You know, they've been at it for much longer than the majority of us. So they have a bit of a head start and they've gotten these numbers. But we're hoping to do the same thing over the next 8 to 10 years to really get greater than 90% of our patients with some sort of planning done.
But replicating the Gunderson model throughout the entire Bay Area is a long way off.
So who has an advanced healthcare directive in place right now?
Educational outreach efforts largely depend on volunteer organizations like the East Bay Conversation Project, a community-wide coalition working to help people plan for care at the end of life. Allison Rodman is addressing a group of Berkeley seniors on how to complete their advanced directives.
So it's a pretty simple document that's legal and has, but you don't have to go to great expense by using a lawyer or having it notarized.
While these volunteer efforts are a good first step, proponents say much more is needed. A well-funded, comprehensive system to educate and inform healthcare providers and patients on planning for the end of life.
And of course, we don't like to think of death or dying, but it happens.
81-year-old great-grandmother Leah Brigham knows from personal experience how important an advance directive is. Several years ago, Leah's husband Jim made the decision to stop medical treatment for his ailing mother.
I came home and my husband was just nearly sobbing. He was just distraught. He said, "I've killed my mother." I said, "Jim." He said, "We stopped her medication." I said, "That's what she wanted."
Unbeknownst to Jim, his mother had filled out an advance directive. After a search, Leah found a copy of it.
We got it out. Her wishes are right here. No medication, blah, blah, blah. So I took that home and I said, "Honey, just take a look at this. This is what your mother wanted. You're not killing her."
Jim stopped agonizing over his mother's death, now that he no longer had to guess at what she wanted. For Cross Currents, I'm Joanne Marr.
That story is part of the End of Life Radio Project, a series supported by a grant from the Association of Healthcare Journalists and the Commonwealth Fund. Next Tuesday, we'll look at the controversy over physician-assisted dying and California's new End of Life Option Act. This is Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hanat Baba. Our next piece comes to us from our project, The Spiritual Edge, reporting on religion in a changing America. The Dalai Lama and Archbishop Desmond Tutu are in their 80s. During a week in 2015, the two spiritual leaders came together in Dharamsala, India, to reflect. They discussed joy in the face of hardship, a topic both men know well. The Dalai Lama has spent close to 60 years in exile from his homeland, Tibet, while Archbishop Tutu helped lead the fight against apartheid in South Africa, and he's now undergoing treatment for prostate cancer. The results of their week-long discussion is the New York Times bestseller, The Book of Joy, co-written by Bay Area author Douglas Abrams. KALW's Judy Silber spoke with Abrams about his experiences with these two important world leaders and their advice on how to cultivate a joyful mind. Abrams starts off by talking about their relationship.
They're incredibly funny together. They tease each other mercilessly. They call each other their mischievous spiritual brother. There's just so much incredible love that they have and respect that they have for each other, and just a fantastic sense of humor that they share.
They had only met maybe half a dozen times before this, and yet there was this great affection, this great affinity that they feel for one another. So, like, what's your evaluation for how that could be,
right,
given that they hadn't had that much time together?
You know, they're from such totally different worlds, you know, South African culture and Tibetan culture. But again, I think it's this reminder that the values of all of our traditions touch at a very sacred and deep place and certain shared values that they recognize in one another. You know, the first lunch, you know, that they were teasing each other, and Archbishop Tutu turns to the Dalai Lama and wags his finger at him and says, "Act like a holy man." So, I mean, they were just ribbing each other and teasing each other the whole time.
Yeah. So, I mean, that seemed like that was a theme throughout the book that yep. there was, I mean, they were talking about joy and the hindrances to joy, but it was effortless for them to be joyful and to be joyful with each other.
You know, I think the goal here, when you ask about the goal of the book, was how do we take something that is often as fleeting and seemingly kind of elusive as joy in a life and a world that often feels so filled with fear, anger, and sadness? And how do we take that joy and move it from just being this kind of fleeting, momentary state to an actual character trait? And I think what you're talking about is these two men exude joy because it is a part of their character. It's something they've practiced and developed and cultivated. And that's what we were really after. How do you do that? How do you have more of that?
So how do you do that?
Well, you know, one of the things that we talked a bunch about was illness, for example. And one of the real kind of shifts is in perspective of how we view that illness. And I asked Archbishop Tutu, and you know, you've had prostate cancer, you're at the hospital, they're poking you, they're prodding you, you're uncomfortable, you're bored, you're getting irritated. How do you shift out of that state of frustration and anger and maybe fear to a state of joy? And he said, well, you know, I look around and I notice the nurse and how loving and kind she is. And I notice and I remember that I'm in a hospital where I am getting this care and that I'm fortunate enough to have the benefit of that. And so it's not just a kind of looking at the glass half full. It's really shifting our perspective to seeing our interconnection with one another and what we are being gifted with on a regular basis and having gratitude for that.
What I read in the book, it seemed like they were talking about skillful means of dealing with a normal mind.
Yeah.
You know, the normal mind that gets frustrated, the normal mind that gets angry, the normal mind that wants things to be different than they are. Each of them has obviously been in very difficult circumstances and up against very, you know, hardline walls, the Chinese in the Dalai Lama's case and apartheid Africa in Bishop Tutu's case. And yet they've maintained these like very positive, optimistic, hopeful attitudes.
You know, at one point, very early on in the discussion, the Dalai Lama was speaking and Archbishop turned to him, interrupted him and said, "So why are you not morose?" And the Dalai Lama didn't know what the word morose was, so he was trying to understand. And Archbishop Tutu said, "Sad. Why are you not sad? You've been turfed out of your country. You've been exiled. And yet you are, as we see you, this kind of ebullient and joyful person." And the Dalai Lama said this quite extraordinary thing, which he said, "Actually, my life in exile has been very enriching." And he said, you know, he wasn't denying the suffering that he had experienced or his people had experienced, but he said, "It brought me closer to the truth." And if he had remained as the Dalai Lama in Lhasa, he said, you know, in his what he referred to as his gilded cage, he never would have had the experiences that he has and been able to give the teachings that he has been able to give. So it was this shift in perspective. And quite frankly, seeing how that adversity can actually be ennobling.
Yeah, I thought that was really interesting. Bishop Tutu gave the example of Nelson Mandela, that when he first went into jail, he was a very angry young man, and it took 27 years of prison to make him into the wise, strong leader that he was.
Well, I did challenge, you know, my job was to kind of challenge them and to be the kind of voice of skepticism and the reader. And I said, you know, well, but yes, it doesn't always happen. Some people go to jail for 27 years and they become bitter and broken. But what he said was, yes, it's true. So suffering can either ennoble us or it can embitter us. And that is our choice. That is where our volition, our will comes in. We can use that suffering and say this is not just some random persecution of the universe toward us, but to take what has happened to us, to learn from it, grow from it, make meaning out of it, use it for the benefit of others, that's when our suffering becomes ennobling. I think they would remind us that that is not an excuse to accept the suffering that is. We must act to alleviate that suffering, and so that the conditions are such that people are less inclined to be drawn to fear, anger, and sadness.
This is Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Our Spiritual Edge project is also interested in how ordinary people cultivate spirituality in their lives. So we've been interviewing Bay Area residents about religion. We want to know what they like, what they reject, and what, if anything, has taken religion's place. Paige Marshall of Oakland is disillusioned by Christianity, but like many who stop going to church, she's still looking for spiritual answers.
My name is Paige Marshall. I am 30 years old, and I don't really feel like I call myself anything. I just know that there is something out there that's greater than me. Like, I guess God, but it's not like a God that I feel like a lot of people identify God with. I grew up in central Wisconsin with a single mom, and she's Baptist. So you have to ask Jesus into your heart, and you're going to go to heaven, and there's going to be like a rapture, and like there's going to be an end of times. When I was like 18, I was just like, well, like, honestly, like, that. I don't believe in like that some kind of God is going to come back and save us all. After I graduated from high school, I moved around the United States for a while. And I just got into a group of friends where like food, farming and stuff like that became really important. And I started practicing yoga and just reading about people that like reached like, enlightenment, or, you know, I was just like amazed by it. I was like, well, what is that? I went to South America. I was in the country of Bolivia for about 2.5 years. And I did a lot of stuff there. I did, you know, tourist stuff. I lived there. I worked on a farm. And it was a thing in that community that I was on to like do like fast for 21 days. And me and this one guy from Argentina, we decided to go to the island of, it's called Lake Titicaca, and it's like basically a little island in between Peru and Bolivia. We decided to fast for 21 days in silence. I guess why, and it's just to see, like, can I do that? I guess because I wasn't satisfied with how life is, you know. I'm like, I just can't, I don't understand what's going on, I can't, it's not, doesn't totally make sense to me, you know. I wanted something more. We rented a house, it was like a two-story house. We had this tiny little kitchen that we weren't really using, no running water or electricity. We had to use candlelight at night. And my bed was on the first floor. And in that room, it was just like one whole wall was just like all glass. And it was facing out into the lake. So every single day I would see the sunset on the lake. And then every single morning I would see the sunrise on the lake. 21 days it's like time just creeps by when you're not eating. My friend, he would like hike around and do stuff, but like I was chilling. I would wake up and like try to meditate, but I couldn't because like my mind was just like racing a lot of the times. I would always drink a lot of water, and I would go to the beach and I'd sit out in the sun and I would bathe in the lake. I remember the sand being like super, not like crystal white, but like very, very close to like a really white color. It'd be like warm and but like windy, but the sun is like so strong that it feels good. So with my friend, we would communicate sometimes through writing, like hand motions or write each other notes. The not eating part, it wasn't really that hard at the beginning. We were like really excited to do it. So we had like a lot of energy and focus on just doing it. But like I would think about food, like my friend and I, we wrote a list of all the places we wanted to eat after the fast. I remember one day actually I had a lucid dream that I was at like this house with somebody and they had all this pizza and I was eating all this pizza and I woke up like, oh, shit, I ate. And then I was like, oh, wait. When it ends, you can't just like eat, you know? It's also you can eat like maybe like soft fruits or something, you know, or like broth. I think I ate a piece of fruit, maybe an apple or something like that. And like my friend and I, we started laughing because it was like so amazing. And it was just like some ordinary apple, but I was like, this is just so amazing, you know? And like, I was so thankful to have it, so grateful for it. I think it's something that I was like, reflect on my whole life, you know, maybe before I did it, I thought it could be like some like, oh, have some like spiritual enlightenment, or it's more that I just understood something really simple and it's just like appreciate what is already in front of me.
That piece was produced by KALW's Judy Silber and was part of a series called Some, Done, or None that's part of our Spiritual Edge project. You can help us with our research by taking our short survey on religion and spirituality. Go to KALW.org, click Cross Currents, and find the Spiritual Edge. That's it for our show today. Our team includes Leela Day, Nina Gensler-Debs, Chris Hoff, Olivia Henry, Jürgen Klemm, Angela Johnston, Lisa Morehouse, Stephen Short, Judy Silber, Andrew Stelzer, Claire Stremple, and Beatrice Thomas. The show was engineered by James Rowlands. The line producer was Liza Veal. Our managing editor is Jen Sheehan. Managing producer is Julie Kane. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.